The Gemara tells us a very interesting event that happened to Rav Rachumi. In the time of the Amoraim, it was not uncommon for Talmidei Chachamim to leave their home for extended periods of time and go to yeshiva and learn. This was something that was an accepted practice. The women supported it. The husbands would learn. And the Gemara in Ksuvos brings a number of different such situations. One is Rav Rachumi, who would learn by Rava. He would leave his home, he would go to the yeshiva of Rava and learn, and his custom was that he would go back home on Erev Yom Kippur. He would stay there for a given amount of time and then come back again. One Erev Yom Kippur, when he was ready to leave, the shiur was extended. It went longer than he anticipated, and as a result, he was not able to make the trip back for Yom Kippur. His wife didn't know that, and his wife was waiting. And as his wife is waiting, she's saying to herself, "When will he come? When will he come?" She heard people approach. "Maybe that's him. That's him. No, that's him. That's him." She waited and waited. It got later and later. At a certain point, Chalash Daite, she gave up, and she started crying. At that moment that she began crying, Rav Rachumi was sitting in the yeshiva on the top floor. The floor upon which he was sitting collapsed, and he fell to his death. And that's the Gemara. And this Gemara is very difficult to understand. It's obvious from this Gemara that the crying of his wife caused his death. She was waiting, anticipating. She finally gave up, and because she began crying, that caused his death. And if you think about this Gemara, it should raise a number of problems. Number one, why should her crying cause his death? And number two, now she's happy? Let's say you tell me that there's a certain pain that she felt, and Hashem felt you have to take some kind of revenge or something for the pain. Now her husband dies, and now all of a sudden she's happy? This Gemara is very difficult to understand. And to understand this Gemara, what I'd like to do is focus on something that we don't often focus on. And that is the Midas HaDin and the Midas HaRachamim. When Hashem created the world, if it could be, Hashem felt that it was appropriate, proper, to create the world with the Midas HaDin, with the attribute of pure justice in place. Justice is appropriate. Justice is proper. When Hashem created the world, it was to allow man to grow, to accomplish, to earn his reward in the world to come. Justice says you're rewarded for what you accomplished. You're held accountable. You're responsible. But din, loosely translated as justice, is extremely demanding. It means you're accountable and you're responsible, whether you intended it, whether you meant it, whether you realize the full extent, the gravity of the situation. If you did X, and from that came why, you are responsible on the good and on the bad. Whilst that was the way Hashem, if it could be, wanted to create the world, and that is the appropriate midah trait with which to create the world, the problem is that if it could be, Hashem saw that the world could not exist. Because din, justice, is so demanding, so exacting, that no human being would escape its clutches. No human being could be omed bedin, because if any human being were judged to the extreme, absolute din, it would be over. And therefore, if it could be, Hashem saw fit to balance out din with rachamim, with mercy. Mercy says, listen, you have to understand where he's coming from, what's his background, did he understand the full gravity of what he was involved in? Did he recognize the consequences? Rachamim mitigates against din. Rachamim says, you have to understand, you have to remember, you have to take it easy on him. However, both must be in existence. If there was no din, then there'd be no reward, no punishment. If there were no justice, you could never be rewarded for what you did appropriate. You could never be rewarded for what you did right. So there has to be din, first of all, because din is yosher, is straight, is right, is appropriate. But secondly, because if there was no din, there'd be no reward, no punishment. On the other hand, there has to be rachem and there has to be mercy, because if there wasn't mercy, there'd be no existence for mankind. And therefore, there's a balance. Both din and rachamim are always in operation. However, it's not always with the same balance that they're measured out. There are different times of the year when rachamim is more in play. Yom Kippur is just such a day. It's a day that's slated, that was created for the purpose of allowing the Jewish people to return to Hashem. It's a day where Hashem acts with more mercy. If you can imagine a slide rule with rachamim on the left and din on the right, normally during the course of the year, the slide rule is somewhere in the middle, 50-50. On Yom Kippur, it slides over more. There's more rachamim introduced into the equation. During certain times of the year, more din is in operation. Certain actions that a person does can affect the balance. The balance between mercy and din can be changed by many things. And those different elements that can change the din are critical for our existence. But there's one more step that we have to understand. Whatever level of din that operates in the world, it is a reality. When Hashem created this world, Hashem created immutable forces of nature. Heat tends to rise. Gases tend to expand. Heavy objects tend to fall. Those laws govern physicality throughout the cosmos. They're irrefutable. They're in total operation. But those rules are neither kind nor cruel. They're reality. If you leave a baby on the changing table, Rahman Salan, and you don't watch out, and the baby turns over, the baby falls to the ground. You don't accuse gravity of being cruel, unkindly, unfeeling. Gravity is a reality. When Hashem created the world, Hashem created forces that govern the physical world and forces that govern the spiritual world. One of the forces that govern the upper world, the spiritual world, is the force of din balanced by rachamim. But whatever level is in play at that moment is reality. That reality is neither kind nor cruel, but it is what the reality is at that moment. And sometimes this can lead to an interesting anomaly, almost a contradiction. I'll share with you what I mean. The Torah tells us, don't oppress the orphan or the widow. Why? Because if you oppress them, Kitzok Yitzok Eli, and they'll scream to me, says Hashem, if you will oppress the orphan or the widow, and they'll cry to me, I will listen to their cry. V'chara api, and I'll be furious. V'aragti eschem, and I'll kill you b'cherev with a sword. V'yuneshechem almanos uvnechem yisomim, your wives will be widows, your children will be orphans. V'yakisak Eli, because if they'll cry to me, v'shamati, I will hear kichanun ani. You have to remember, I'm merciful. Says Hashem, you have to remember that I'm merciful, and if the orphan and the widow cry out to me, I will take vengeance upon you, I will kill you and your children, they will be left bereft. Now, if you think about it, that doesn't sound very merciful. Because I am merciful, I will kill you in anger. That sounds a little strange. And the Kochavei Or, one of the great Bali Musar, explains this to us with a mashal. He says, imagine a man who's very, very kindly, and imagine another man who's cruel. Both of these men are walking down the block, and both witness the same scene. What's the scene? They see two people walk out of a bar, and one smashes the other one in the jaw. For no reason. For no reason whatsoever, he hits his friend. And his friend gets up off the ground, and he hits him again. And again, the guy falls down. And again, the fellow smashes him and hits him without cause, without reason. The fellow who's cruel will pass by and say, tough luck, Charlie. Too bad. The fellow who's merciful will look at that and say, why are you doing that? Stop it. What are you doing? And if the fellow doesn't stop it, he'll jump into the fight, stop it, and he'll smash the guy, and he'll hit him, and he'll knock the assailant to the ground. Why? Because his mercy was awoken for the fellow who's being attacked, and because he's merciful, and because he's kindly, he's going to attack the attacker. The fellow who's cruel doesn't care. The person who's merciful feels the pain of the one who's attacked, and because of that, he'll turn against the attacker and take revenge. Hashem acts in this world with midos. Hashem acts in the world with different traits, and the trait of mercy, while normally is very good for us and very kindly to us, sometimes has a negative effect. Hashem says, because of my mercy, if you're going to oppress the orphan and the widow, it's going to awaken my mercy, and the result is mercy for them will be din for you. You'll be held accountable. You'll be held fully responsible, fully liable. Why? Because my mercy has been awoken by that poor person's cry, and mercy to them will reflect in din, judgment against you. Why? Because you too are on the opposite sides of this issue. And this understanding is critical in understanding relationships between one person and the other. If human beings become antagonists and become you against me or me against you, if you awaken Hashem's midah of mercy, that's going to become very, very harsh against me, because the mercy itself will invoke more din, more judgment. It changes the balance that I'm measured with and changes the equation. And I believe that's the answer for Rav Ruchumi. You see, this woman was an Isha Kashera. Here's a woman who sacrificed everything so that her husband can sit and learn, to be without a husband for months at a time. And she's sitting there, Erev Yom Kippur, waiting. Where's my husband? Waiting. Maybe that's him. No, maybe that's him. Maybe that's him. And finally, she realizes it's almost going to be Yom Kippur. It's too late. He's not coming. And she begins crying. And if it could be that awoke in the midah of Rachamim and Hashem, and Hashem said, "Oy, the poor woman, looks how she's suffering." And when Hashem had rachamim on her, the result was din on her husband, on the one who caused it. Did he think about it? No. Was he responsible? No. But any human being who's judged with absolute din will not come clean. And it probably wasn't because of anything he did at that moment that he lost his life. But now he was judged with a more strict system. He was no longer judged with as much mercy as normally. He was judged more with justice. And when a person is omed bedin, din alone, it is very, very unlikely that any human being will come clean. But it's because she awoke, and if it could be the midah of rachamim, and Hashem had mercy on her, therefore it changed the midah with which Hashem judged him. There's always a balance when two people are on the opposite sides of an equation. The mercy on her causes din on him because he's the protagonist. He's the attacker, albeit not intentionally, but he's the one who caused her pain. And because he's the one who caused her pain, because Hashem has mercy on her, it changes the din and changes the way he's judged. Is it fair? Everything is fair. Because if he didn't deserve death for some other reason, the system of din would not have taken him. But the changing of rachamim to din is sometimes very, very different than we think. You and I would not be held accountable to this level, but he was a tzaddik of that caliber. Hashem is medaktik with chassidim, with the purely righteous to a higher degree, and he was so great that he was held accountable, and because of that, he lost his life. And I believe that there is a tremendous lesson for us. While we are not Rav Ruchumi, and we certainly hope we'll never be held to anywhere near that type of din, I believe there's a tremendous lesson for us to learn from this. And I'll share with you what that is. I often speak to young people who are going out, and oftentimes the question is this the right one? So I go through the litany, the typical questions. Do you enjoy the date? Absolutely. Do you have a good time together? Yeah. And does the conversation sort of flow? Does it feel natural? Yep, absolutely. But I decided to drop her. Why? Well, I feel I could do better. Granted, I enjoy our company. And granted, it seems that we sort of fit well together. But I don't want to continue because I feel I can do better. And I've heard that line time after time. And every time I hear that line, I could do better, I share with them a mushel. And that mushel is as follows. Imagine that you have a wedding 2 weeks from now, and you need a pair of shoes. So you shop. You cannot find a pair of shoes. You need a brown pair of shoes, and you cannot find them. You shop here, you shop, can't find it. 2 days before the wedding, you find it. Oh my goodness, it's perfect. The leather is gorgeous. The workmanship is so fine. And it's in fashion, and it's on sale, 50% off. Oh my goodness, what a matzia. Only one problem. The shoes are two sizes too small. Listen, I can't pass up such a matzia. So you buy the pair and put them on, and you wear them to the wedding. What is going to happen? I'd like to share with you that after 2 hours of dancing, your feet are going to kill you. Because the leather could be fine. They could be highly fashionable. But if the shoe doesn't fit, it's going to pinch, it's going to hurt, it's not the right size. And any time a young man or young woman says, I could do better, I say to them, you might be right. But if you could do better, that doesn't mean it's going to be the right fit. Hashem is mezavig zivugim. Hashem sets the right person for you, the perfect fit. And if you feel that you can find a better one, you might be right. You can find someone more intelligent or smarter or prettier or wealthier or whatever criteria you're into. You might very well find a better one, but you're not going to find one that fits. And if you marry the wrong person, oh, it could be wonderful. Look at all the mileage she has. Wonderful. But if it doesn't fit, you're going to be one miserable human being and one miserable couple. And this concept that when we go out, we are looking for our bashert, the one that Hashem set for us, is one of the basic tenets of our religious belief system. Gemara tells us that 40 days before a man is born, Hashem sets for that person the bito shaploni, laploni, the daughter of such and such for such and such. Before you came into this world, Hashem found the perfect fit. Your job when you're going out is to look for that one. But the Gra tells us that really it goes much further than that. Explains the Gra, you're not just looking for the right fit. You're looking for the one that Hashem designed for you. You see, the Gra makes an interesting observation. The Gemara tells us that before Hashem created Adam, Hashem wanted to create them two. Hashem thought to make them two. And in the end, Hashem made them one and then split them. Asked the Gra, what do you mean? Hashem thought one way and then changed his mind. Hashem thought to make them two and then made them one. Explains the Gra that Hashem wanted there to be two human beings who fit together perfectly. But the only way you could create two human beings who fit together exactly and perfectly is to create them as one and then separate them. Because if you create two separate entities, they're not exactly matching, they don't exactly fit together. And what the Gra is sharing with us is that a husband and wife are perfectly matched one to the other. But I want to share with you one more step so we really put this into perspective. The Reishis Chochma brings down that this is a fallacy. If you believe that before you were born, Hashem searched around and found for you the perfect fit, you're fundamentally misunderstanding this Gemara. Explains Reishis Chochma, it starts in the world of neshamas. There's a male part and a female part of the neshama. They're one unit. Hashem separates them and then puts them into different bodies for them to meet again, become again one unit, and remain that way for eternity when they leave this world. but in the Olam HaNeshamas, they were one, separated, put into different families, into different bodies, into different lives, then given the opportunity to find each other again. And when it says that Hashem says the daughter of such and such and such and such, it's because Hashem separates them, puts them into different families, puts them into different households, and then Hashem orchestrates the events so that they meet together again. And the Ramban explains to us that the closest relationship on the planet is husband and wife, far closer than a son to a mother, far closer than a daughter to a father, far closer than siblings. Explains the Ramban, v'hayu l'basar echad, they become one unit, the closest relative, the closest relationship. Nothing begins to compare between the bonding, the attachment between husband and wife. And while that is a beautiful concept, and when used appropriately and properly, creates a harmony and a togetherness that is magnificent, that very closeness also can come with the cost. That cost is that oftentimes a husband or a wife will hurt one another. Oftentimes it is that a husband or a wife will hurt the other one more deeply and cause them more pain than any other human being in the world. And I'd like to share with you one of the realities of life. The single person who will most likely hurt you more deeply than anyone else is your spouse. The single person who will most likely make you more angry than any other human being on the planet is your spouse. And the single person that you will most likely hate more than anyone else on the planet is your spouse. It is unlikely that you'll ever be hurt, unlikely that you'll ever feel that anger, and unlikely that you'll ever feel that sense of hate as you feel to your spouse. And the reason for that is because it is the most intimate relationship in existence. And we human beings make mistakes, we slip up, and we say the wrong things at the wrong time. And because it is such a close, open relationship, it allows for such deep hurt. And there's another element about why it is that a husband and wife will hurt each other more than any other person on the planet. You see, normally we don't hate that many people. We're socially intelligent. If there's a fellow in shul who rubs me the wrong way, I don't sit next to him. If there's a person who I find, for whatever reason, I find him obnoxious, I don't talk to him much. I say good Shabbos, I say hello, and I walk away. But you can't avoid your spouse. You can't run away from your other half. And if there are words that she says, the words that you say, you can't ignore them, you can't run away, and they're always there. And because a couple are so close, so open one with the other, they're also so vulnerable. And because they're so vulnerable, the sense of pain that one can cause the other is greater than any pain in existence. And I'd like to share with you that pain is exactly the issue that surfaces so many times. Do you know why it is that you're going to get so angry at your spouse? Because how could she do that to me? This is supposed to be my best friend. This is supposed to be my lover. This is supposed to be the person with whom I'm bonded, I'm together, and how could she do that to me? She knows my inner secrets. She knows what's valuable and important to me, and she hurt me so deeply, penetrated to the core of my essence, and it's that pain that causes the anger. It's that pain that causes me to feel those very, very powerful senses. And it's that pain that causes much of the fighting that happened in a marriage. When I was a kid, I remember very vividly my mother, Alei Shalom's bedroom. On one wall was a dresser with a mirror, and on the opposite wall was another mirror. The two mirrors faced one another. And I remember as a little child walking in and looking into the mirror. And as I'd look at the mirror that was on the dresser, I'd see the reflection of me in that mirror, but also I would see the reflection of me in the mirror behind me. And that reflection of me in the mirror behind me reflected back onto the mirror on the dresser. And that reflection reflected back. And you'd see the reflections back and forth and back and forth. It wasn't one of me, it wasn't two of me. There were hundreds of me. And I remember always looking to find the last me. One, two, three, four, where's the last me? And I could never find the last me because each mirror perfectly reflected back to the other. And you'd always see more and more and more and more and more and more and more. Try asking a married couple the following question. What caused the fight? What caused the fight? He said, she said, he said, he said, well, stop. Who? What caused it? You've been fighting for 2 days now. You've been screaming at each other, yelling. What caused it? And you know what the answer is? Most of the time, no one could quite identify. You see, it's I felt hurt. And because I felt hurt, I said something. Then she felt hurt because of what I said. And then she said something. And back and forth, like those images in the mirror. It keeps going back and forth and forth and back and back and forth. And interestingly enough, when each of them walks into the Rav's study and says what happens, they forget what they did, but remember clearly what their spouse did. Do you know what he said to me? He said, blah, 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 blah. And she forgets to mention what she's been screaming for the past 2 days about. And each one only feels the barbs, the arrows, the cutting remarks of the other, but they don't realize that they're reacting back. And the difficulty in a marriage often comes about because he said something, then she said something, then he said, then she said, and bouncing like the images in the mirror, back and forth and back and forth. And it continues on and on. And it won't stop until one of them is man enough to say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. And it's almost amazing. In a healthy marriage, when one of them is man enough or woman enough to stand up and say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, the other one melts and says, no, I was also wrong. Doesn't always work that way, but the fight will continue for sure until one of them apologizes, one of them says, I was wrong. And I want to explain something to you that is so fundamental to a successful marriage. What is it that you're apologizing for? It's not what you said. It's not what you did. It's the hurt feelings. And when you understand that, you'll understand the art of the apology. An apology is an artful technique of regaining a sense of balance and bringing back shalom bayis. But it's exactly that. It's an artful method of changing the climate of the relationship at that time. And most people don't spend enough time to analyze and understand what it is that makes an apology effective. And I'd like to share with you three rules. Three rules how to make an apology actually work. Rule number one, I learned in a very interesting situation. A number of years ago, I was pulled over by a highway policeman. And he walked over and asked the question the policeman always asked, do you know why I pulled you over? And I remember clearly looking at him and said, officer, I was speeding. There was no excuse. And I believe that his jaw dropped. What? I said, officer, I apologize. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I try not to speed. I was speeding. There's no excuse. He didn't know what to say. I mean, you have to understand, this is a highway cop. He hears more excuses than a sixth grade teacher about why my homework wasn't done. He's heard it all. And he just heard the words, officer, I was speeding, there's no excuse. He went to his patrol car, looked up on the computer. He came back to me and gave me a written citation. He said, please drive more carefully and be careful. I took that written citation and I framed it. You could ask my kids. It was in a frame in my study because it took me 20 years of learning Mussar to do that, to say the words, officer, I was wrong and there is no excuse. And he was so shocked by that that instead of issuing me a ticket, he issued me a warning not to speed anymore. I framed that warning because it took me 20 years of learning Mussar to be able to say the words, I was wrong and there is no excuse. And the first rule of an effective apology is don't ruin an apology with a but. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Let's imagine, and this can go on either side, either the guy or the girl. For convenience sake, I'm going to assume the guy blew it. He said something he shouldn't have said. Whatever it may have been, he said something callous, whatever it might have been. And he realizes he did it, shouldn't have done it. And he comes to his wife and he says, dear, I know you were hurt and I'm sorry that I did that. But you should know, you know, it really, I think you overreacted a little bit. Now, you look at it, what a tzaddik. The guy admitted he was wrong. You know, he couldn't help but mention that, you know, he thinks she overreacted. And, you know, he apologized. That's a great guy, right? But I'd like to share with you what his wife hears. His wife was hurt. His wife felt that the one she trusted, the one she loved, the one she committed her life to, cut into the essence of her. And not only doesn't he fully get it, he explains that she's wrong. And while he's saying the words, I'm wrong, the but says to her very clearly that he really doesn't get it. He really doesn't understand how much it is that he hurt me. So what does she do? Obviously, she has to explain to him how much it is that he hurt her. You think I overreacted? You don't even know. I should have reacted double. And she explains to him clearly how bad it is what he did. What does he hear? Oh my goodness, she's really serious about this. Not only did she exaggerate in the beginning, now she's doubly exaggerating. So what does he do? He has to explain to her, come on, dear, you do know my words weren't that hurtful. You did overreact. Come on, right? What does she hear? Oh my goodness. Not only this guy doesn't understand how badly he hurt me, he's now defending himself. What does she do? She explains to him even more clearly how bad it is what he did. And it escalates and escalates up and up until they're in a bigger fight than they were before. Don't ruin a good apology with a but. Dear, I said those words. I hurt you. I'm sorry. You're right. You heard those words hurt me. You have no idea. You're right. You have no idea how much they hurt me. You're right. Dear. You have no idea. You're right. I had a guy say the words, I'm sorry. 100 times, 100 times, I said, you have to say these words over and over and no excuse, no but. And after, I don't know if it was exactly 100 times or pretty close, his wife calmed down and it ended a major fight that they had been in. But if you say the words, I'm sorry, but you should just know that you were also guilty, you're missing the whole point. And you're missing the point that what she's going to hear is not the apology part. She's going to hear that he really doesn't get it. He doesn't understand how much it is that he hurt me. So the first rule is don't ruin a good apology with a but. The second rule of apologies is never apologize if you don't know what you've done wrong. If you don't understand what it is that you've done wrong, don't apologize. Now, you may be saying to yourself, now, wait a minute, if that's true, I'll never apologize, because for the life of me, I can never figure her out. I can never figure him out. So, obviously, I'm never going to apologize, and the fights are going to go on forever. I learned an interesting lesson from a landlord. We had commercial space, and I got a call from the leasing agent, something that they want to, something that I felt was really nasty. And I called up the landlord, and I left him a voicemail. He called me back, and he said, I'm terribly sorry. It's obvious that I insulted you. I'm sorry. Had I wanted to insult you, it wouldn't bother me. But I really didn't want to. I apologize. And I learned a tremendous lesson from his words. If I wanted to insult you, it would have been one thing. I didn't even want to. Do you know what you're apologizing for? It's not the words you said, not the act you did, not the fact that you were late. It's the fact that your spouse was hurt. It's not that you left your socks on the floor the 10,000th time, not that you bounced another check. It's the fact that your spouse was hurt. And if it's a wife apologizing to a husband or a husband apologizing to a wife, what I'm apologizing for is not the words, because the words don't matter. Not the act, because the act doesn't matter. The issue is never the words, never the act. The issue is the hurt feelings. How could you have done that to me? How could you have done that? Because we're the closest, most open. I relied on you. I depended on you. I was waiting outside in the cold, and you were late again. It wasn't that she waited. It wasn't that it was cold. It was the feeling of being forgotten, the feelings that she felt, and her feelings were hurt, and that's what you're apologizing for. So if you don't know what it is that you're apologizing for, no one understands. You do know exactly. It's the fact that you were hurt. You're my spouse. We're supposed to be one unit. We're supposed to be the best of friends. We're supposed to be in this together. I to support you, you to support me, and I let you down. And for that, I'm sorry. You were hurt because of me, and I feel badly for that. And whether I understand it or not, it doesn't matter. It's the feelings that I'm apologizing for. Which brings us to the third rule of an apology. And that is, the less you understand your spouse's reaction, the more you had better start understanding it. And if that sounds like a contradiction to the second rule, it is and it's not. But I'll explain to you what this rule is. When your husband reacts in a way that for the life of you, you can't understand, why is he carrying on? Why is he making such a big deal? Why is he making such a fuss? It was just a little thing. What that means is you fundamentally don't understand what's going on in his emotional world. You fundamentally don't understand why this issue was so critical and important to him. And if you want this not to happen again, you had better start looking in and asking yourself why. And what couples do all too often is say the words, oh, it's just a guy, it's just a woman, it's a woman's thing, it's a guy's thing. And every guy is this abusive creep, and every woman is a crybaby. And as I mentioned in previous shmuzim, that is a very dangerous thing to do in a marriage, because A, it's not true, B, you'll never understand your spouse. Men and women are different, different temperaments, different value systems. And to be successfully married, you have to study your spouse. You have to understand them. And when there's a reaction that you completely, totally don't understand, you have to get to work and ask yourself, why did she react that way? She's a sane, rational, reasonable person. Yet she's doing something that, in my understanding, is so outrageous that either she's insane or I don't understand her. So while you apologize for hurting her feelings, while you apologize for the pain that she feels, you also owe it to yourself and to her to figure out a little bit better what makes her tick, what makes you tick, so that you could be more successfully married. And the art of an apology is such a significant tool to be used in a marriage. I don't care who you married, I guarantee that they're going to do things that bother you. I don't care how great a tzaddik, how great a tzaddik is. All of us human beings have flaws, have idiosyncrasies, have shortcomings, and things that we don't do well. And the recognition that I've done things that hurt my spouse, and he or she clearly is in pain, and this is going to continue until one of us says, I'm sorry, is an important recognition. And interestingly enough, you don't have to always take full responsibility. You can't mention it, but even if you recognize that you're 25% wrong, you can go over in an honest apology and say, "Dear, I hurt your feelings and I'm sorry." And even if you hold that your husband is 75% the one who's wrong, you don't have to tell him that. And you forget the but, and you could apologize because the reality is that his feelings are hurt. Why did he react that way? Why did he carry on that way? He normally doesn't do that. With his chavrusa, he never acts that way. With the guys in shul, he never carries on that way. But he was hurt. And while it may be true that he was mostly responsible, the bottom line is he was hurt. And oftentimes it is that the one who's less guilty has to apologize. And when you apologize, then your spouse also is able to accept the responsibility and able to accept what they did as wrong. The reality is that in any situation in a marriage, any fight, there's enough blame to go around. There's never one party who's completely innocent and the other completely guilty. It happens to be irrelevant who's right and who's wrong. The only thing that's relevant is that you're in a state of war shooting arrows one at the other, and you have to stop that state of war. Because if you don't stop it, it's like those two mirrors. One shoots against the other, against the other, against the other, and it escalates and escalates. And the first thing you have to learn is how to apologize. You have to get up and say the words, "I was wrong, I'm sorry," and you quiet down. No but. And even if your spouse doesn't immediately accept it, you're right, there's no excuse. You're right, there's no excuse. But you're right, there's no excuse. If you hold to your guns and you stand your ground, eventually, and usually not long after, your spouse recognizes that you're sincere. You hurt his feelings, you feel badly, and it changes it. So the first thing I have to learn is how to apologize. And the second thing that a husband and wife both have to learn is how to accept an apology. The reality is that things happen. Marriage is a learning process. All of us go through the steps and all of us make mistakes. People change. Things that one time were important no longer are. Things that weren't important become. And the reality is that husbands and wives both make mistakes. And when your spouse is man enough or woman enough to say the words, "I'm sorry," you have to reciprocate and say, "I accept. I understand that you're sorry. Thank you for saying that. I also share some of the guilt. I'm sorry that I hurt you." Because you see, it's never the issue. It's not the being late or the check bouncing or the toothpaste or the whatever. It's never the issue. It's always the feelings, the hurt feelings. My bonded partner, my life's partner, the one who everything we're supposed to do together, reached out and instead of embracing me, shot an arrow directly into my heart. I was so vulnerable, so open, and she did that. The pain that I feel, that's what you're apologizing for. You have to learn how to apologize, and you have to learn to accept an apology. And I want to mention one last step. Sometimes women act foolishly. Let's assume for a minute the husband does whatever it may be. He left his socks on the floor for the 10,000th time, or he forgot what you asked him to go shopping for, or whatever it may be. And there's always lots and lots of ways to paint the picture. The woman says to herself, "That's it. I have had it. There is no way in the world he's going to get away with this." And she decides she's going to let him have it. "Madam, I have a simple question. Do you think that your letting him have it is going to accomplish something? What's going to happen? He's going to come home and you're going to give it to him, but good. So what's going to happen? He's going to fall on the floor and say, 'You're right, dear. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.'" Not exactly. You're going to shoot your arrows at him. He's going to shoot back at you. You're going to shoot back and back and forth and back and forth. And before you know it, it's World War III. "Well, I can't just let him get away with it, can I?" Someone has to show him the right way. Okay, you have two choices. You could be right, or you could be married. You could be right. He could be late or lazy or whatever. Let's even say you're right. When you told him the 9,990 times before, did it change? It's not going to change now. Does he have to change? Yes. And do you have to communicate? Yes. But this is not communicating. This is called starting a fight. But I'm justified. I'm right. You could be right, and you could also be in tremendous pain. And many a time, a wife or a husband decide that that's it. I have to show her. I have to show him the right way. I'm not just going to put up with this. And she blurts out, that is not educating your husband. It's not communicating. It's screaming and yelling and causing a fight. If you feel that your needs in this marriage are not being met, you communicate that, not with anger, not by shooting arrows. And you sit down in a quiet time, in a time of peace, and you say to your husband, I appreciate everything that you do for us. I appreciate how hard you work to earn a living. I appreciate how much time you spend with the kids. And I appreciate everything that you do for us. And I have unending appreciation. Happens to be this one area, it would just make me so much happier if you could do this. You say it once, maybe a second time, and then you close your mouth and you don't repeat it. Because I guarantee that if you're going to say it again and again and again, your husband's not only not going to get it, and it's going to cause the opposite reaction. And sometimes in a marriage, there'll be situations that aren't fair. And sometimes it'll be that you'll do something for your husband called besovil. You'll put up with it, even though he's wrong, and even though he's done it before. Different people have different natures. Change is very difficult. And your ability to say, it's not right, but I'm not going to make a fuss over it, is a big key to Shalom Bayis. I think what this Gemara is sharing with us is a very frightening concept. When a couple are fighting one with the other, well, guess what? They're awakening the Midas Adin to an extent that's hard to imagine. When a couple are fighting, the Shechina leaves. And exactly as Chazal say, it's Ish V'Isha, when Hashem's amongst them, it's peace, it's harmony, it's beautiful. When Hashem leaves, they're Ish and Ish, one fire consuming the other. And the quickest way to divorce Hashem from your marriage is to fight. And when you fight, what you're doing is you're acting in a very different way than you normally act. Normally, I'm so tolerant. Normally, I'm so understanding. But when I get into a fight, I'm extremely exacting. I give no quarter. And I act with extreme din. And the way I act, they act with me in Shemayim. Chazal tell us, b'midash adam modeid, with the measuring stick with which you measure, they measure you up above. When you're in a fight, you allow no mercy. You brook no excuses. You act with din, and that's the way they act with you in Shemayim. And when a couple are fighting, it's not just that they're causing each other so much pain, they're changing the way they're viewed in Shemayim. It will never be viewed the same extreme din as Amoraim or Tanoim. But I think what this Gemara is sharing with us is that Rav Rachumi, as great as he was, and when he caused his wife pain, it changed the Midas HaDin, took away some of the Rachamim. He was now judged with more strict justice, and because of that, he lost his life. And a couple who get into fights, it's part of the game. Unfortunately, it's part of being married. But to recognize that you have to learn from it. You have to stop the fight as soon as you can. You have to apologize. You have to understand what an apology is. I'm not apologizing for the issue. I'm not even apologizing for the words. I'm apologizing for the pain that I caused you. When you understand that, intuitively, you know how to apologize. You don't ruin an apology with a but. You don't apologize until you know what you did wrong. You don't have to understand exactly what caused the pain, because I'm apologizing for the pain that you feel. And then if you don't understand it, you go back and study it. Because the only way fights end is when one or the other stands up and is man enough to say, I was wrong, I'm sorry, I hurt your feelings. And when your spouse does that, what you do is you accept that apology. I'm so happy you said that. I also share some of this responsibility. I'm also sorry. And you make up. And even if you feel that he didn't fully get it, and even if you feel it wasn't the most sincere apology in the world, you accept it, and you say to yourself, probably there's more than enough blame to go around, and probably someone else looking at me might just say, I also have a lot to be blamed for. You apologize back, and you make peace, and you continue as a couple in Shalom and Reyes. A marriage is meant to be the most beautiful, harmonious relationship, certainly the closest, but because it's so close, oftentimes we cause one the other pain. And I want to close with one story that I think is very illustrative of this concept. The Chazon Ish was a Gadol Bisrael, and he was known that he wouldn't accept money or donations. He lived very, very simply, and he would not accept money. And one day, the Chazon Ish is walking with a Talmud, and a rather sad woman approaches, and she insists that the Chazon Ish takes money and pray on her behalf. She took out a 10-shilling note, which the Chazon Ish readily accepted, and they parted company. The student was very surprised because the Chazon Ish always had a policy. He didn't accept money or donations. So he said to the Chazon Ish, what's pshat? Why did the Chazon Ish suddenly change his minug? And the Chazon Ish turned to his Talmud and said, a person is obligated to do chesed in any way possible. In this instant, the biggest chesed I could do for this woman was to accept that money. That was chesed for her. And what the Chazon Ish is sharing with us is that many a time, chesed isn't just bringing soup and potatoes. What chesed is about is meeting that person's needs. And sometimes the greatest chesed you could do for your spouse is to apologize, to accept responsibility. But who's going to teach him? How's he going to learn? I'll tell you one thing, fighting with him isn't going to teach him. And it surely isn't the way to learn. But he'll get away with it. There's no getting away. You're one unit. You're both working and both growing. And sometimes the greatest chesed you could do is accept responsibility even when you're not fully responsible. Even when you're 10% responsible, you say the words, I know what I've done has hurt you. I feel badly. Please forgive me for what I've done. And that could be the greatest chesed that you offer your spouse and the greatest chesed you offer yourself. Because if you're a wholesome couple, and even if not, after a while of doing it, it works. You apologize, he apologizes. Together you come back to a different point and you bring back the shalom. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, the fortitude to enact this and to bring shalom in our relationships.